You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Trump administration has issued a new moratorium on evictions until the end of the year. We'll talk to a housing law attorney about what it means for renters here in Wisconsin. First, for many people, finding a balance between parenting and working can be challenging in the best of times. And when the coronavirus pandemic arrived in the U.S., that combination became significantly more difficult for just about everyone as schools moved online and many jobs moved home as well. Some kids are now back in school, but many of them are doing it virtually, and childcare may be hard to find or to feel comfortable with. And parents who still have a job are still trying to work while caring for their kids. And we want to hear from you. Does this describe what you've been going through the past few months? What's been the hardest part to deal with? Have you found any approaches that have made it easier? And if you have kids, are they back in school in person or virtually? Has your school district taken into account how their plan will match up with the demands of your job? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We wanted to revisit a conversation we had with Deb Perlman. She created the Smitten Kitchen blog in 2006, and we've had her on as a guest for Food Friday several times. In July, she was with us to talk about her piece for the New York Times titled, "In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job. You Can't Have Both." Deb, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Deb, can you give us a sense of what your work-parenting balance was pre-COVID?
It was not balanced. I don't actually think balance is something that exists. It's like a mythical concept. But I would say that things were closer to in balance. My kids went to school. I have a kid who is going into kindergarten and one that's going into sixth grade. I worked from home all day, and my husband had a job in office. And when the kids needed to go someplace after school, we had a babysitter that came. And I guess, you know, it worked. It wasn't ideal. Childcare is expensive. It was a significant part of our earnings even before, but we managed to make do.
And then fast forward to when COVID hit, and you are in New York, so you were in a very hot spot and one of the earlier places that was dealing with this. What happened when the pandemic changed everything?
What happened was, you know, schools were canceled and, you know, everybody kind of understood that it needed to happen. My husband was working from home instead of an office. I was already working from home, except for I wasn't working from home. I was homeschooling my kids. So my husband, who has a real boss, I'm self-employed. I am my own boss. I don't mean to disparage myself, but my husband had a real boss. And so he didn't miss a phone call or meeting. I mean, you know how it is. You can't be offline at any point when your boss is looking for you. So I handled most of the things during the day, and then I would end up working until about like 2 in the morning trying to get done everything that I didn't get done. And it was very, very stressful. But, you know, I understand that relative to the struggles that other working families have had, this is truly nothing. But I can tell you that it was stressful for us. And the whole time I just kept thinking, like, how is this going to work? Why is nobody talking about how impossible this is? Like, the fact is that if you both have to be at your jobs, and again, I have some flexibility, so I just flexed my way out of a job, basically, during the day. But if you both have to work, or even if you're a single parent, you have to work, and your kids are supposed to be homeschooled, how? Which job are you not supposed to do? Like, how is this tenable? Well, maybe it's just a couple months. And then what happened was at the end of the school year, we started getting, you know, the emails from the school, like, we're not really sure we're doing this fall, but it looks like, you know, probably kids will be home 3 days and maybe they'll go to school 1 or 2 days a week. And I was like, oh my God, this is never going to end. I mean, it's not never, but of course it's, we were so surprised and disappointed to learn that 4 months later, there was really no real plan of how we were going to make this work. And that's where the op-ed came from, which was that, how are we supposed to do this? Are my kids supposed to skip kindergarten? Are they supposed to skip sixth grade, or are we supposed to skip paying rent this year? Hmm.
Well, and you say that many parents that you have talked to or seen posting in different social media communities, things like that, this is a very common concern, frustration, source of exhaustion. And yet you say that not a lot of people are giving voice to that. Why do you think that is?
You know, I have read articles about parents struggling in the, you know, during COVID and kids struggling. I read a lot, but a lot of it was painting it as an emotional concern. It was that parents were burnt out. Parents are fried. Parents are at their wit's end. And I was like, we're not burnt out. We're not fried. This isn't emotional. This is an economic policy that's crushing us. It is telling us that businesses can be open, but schools can't. We're the ones being ground up in the gears. I'm not going to have emotional problems if we can solve this economic one. So I feel like when we pass things off as an emotional concern, we use it as an excuse to ignore it. This is the effect. It's not the cause. And that was the perspective that I wasn't hearing, which is why I, as somebody who usually writes about like cake and banana bread and spaghetti and meatballs, was like, I need to say something. I kept waiting for somebody else to write the article and nobody did. And so I guess I just stepped into it.
Well, and I think also something that you actually did in the first 5 minutes of our conversation and something that I have found myself doing as well is saying, I'm struggling with this. This is a problem. I can't do X anymore, and then immediately following it up with, but I know for so many people it's so much worse. And I wonder if that's part of it, too, is that there's a little bit of self-consciousness or even guilt or shame in saying, like, I can't make this work, because we know there are people who are struggling even more.
Absolutely. I mean, I talked about this in the article. I'm like, we are privileged. We have a significant amount of privilege. We had two incomes. We were able to afford childcare. We had savings. When my kids needed markers and books and whatever for, you know, homeschooling, we just grabbed it. We didn't think, oh my God, where is this money going to come from? I have a flexible job. And so therefore, I say it's flexible, but, you know, I might just miss my book deadlines. God, I hope my editors aren't listening. So flexible isn't, you know, I may not get fired tomorrow. I think it's important to be aware of how many things we might still have going for us despite this, like, you know, how many things, you know, if you are two working class parents or one working class parent, or you have a job that's considered you essential, as in you actually have to physically be there, you're in so much worse of a jam. But I do feel like a lot of parents weren't speaking up for a couple reasons. And the first is that you can't go on social media and complain that you're having a hard time at work doing it. Mm-hmm. It's going to basically announce to any boss in a capitalist society that somebody else could do your job better. Nobody can risk not having a job right now. Unemployment is at a catastrophic high. So you can't go online and say you're having a hard time. You also don't want to sound like you're really volunteering your kids to go back to school when we know it might not be safe. We don't actually know that sending kids back is safe. It's not looking good. Nobody wants to be the parent who volunteered their kids for the salt mine only to find out that it was actually unsafe and a very bad idea. And I also just think the third part is that if you're homeschooling all day and you're working, doing your job until 2 a.m, who's got energy left to write an op-ed? I mean, I would talk to my friends about this. I would talk to mom friends. We were all talking about it, but nobody has time to yell about it. So I don't know. I guess I did.
We're talking with Deb Perlman right now. She created the Smitten Kitchen blog in 2006. And we are talking with her today about a recent opinion piece she wrote for the New York Times titled, In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job. You Can't Have Both. Deb, you say in your article that when people do talk about it, the conversation often focuses on the wrong things, and that serves to deflect attention from what the real core issues are. And one of those is, you just kind of touched on, is whether schools are safe, teachers could get sick. It's almost pitting parents and teachers against each other when really they should be on the same team.
It is the last thing I want to do. I absolutely understand why teachers are saying, I can't even get enough paper towels for my classroom. We keep running out of chalk, and you're going to tell me that you can protect us against COVID? I totally understand. And in New York, I mean, again, you know, in New York especially, we have underfunded, overcrowded, understaffed public schools. They're not, you know, there are some wonderful schools, and it doesn't mean that they're not doing an amazing job with what they have, but these are not, this is not a place that can just pivot. We can't just magically invent 8 square foot per kid. They don't even have a budget for a lot of their school supplies, unless plexiglass dividers and PPEs. And there's a lot of logistical questions that aren't being answered. And I think the problem is that it's coming off as parents versus teachers. And I think that we should be moving our concerns further up the chain. Schools need money. They need funding, and they need the ability to think outside the box. This is not something that schools can do. state governments can. The federal government could open its wallet. There are creative solutions, but they're not going to come from your local school district, and it's unfair to expect them to.
Well, and one of the interesting aspects of that is just kind of asking that question assumes that teachers, that there's no overlap between the group of people who are teachers and the group of people who are parents. And there's a lot of overlap there. And so if you have teachers who are going back into what's potentially an unsafe environment, they also have to figure out what to do with their kids.
It's absolutely impossible. In fact, early on, one of the most heartbreaking things I was hearing from was actually one of my son's former teachers, and she was home with her two kids, and her husband had a job that he cannot miss a minute of. So she was supposed to be homeschooling her two kids while fully teaching a kindergarten class, not like kids that you can send off to do work on their own, fully teaching a kindergarten class remotely. And her story to me was so heartbreaking because, I mean, we talk about it being hard. It's impossible for a teacher with kids. And then I also heard from a lot of teachers who have elderly parents at home, or they have their own 7-year-old who's immunocompromised. They can't walk in, their trust in the schools to keep them safe is limited, and they're correct too. But I think the problem is that it's not us versus schools. It's, can we think more creatively about schools? Can the schools get the funding that they need to open? And if they can't, and I'm not just looking at schools to fix this, can we protect parents' jobs? Can workplace protections be put in? Can you have paid leave if you need to teach your kids all day? Can you not be professionally penalized if you can't make a meeting because is the official government policy that it's okay if my kid misses kindergarten in sixth grade as long as I can pay my rent on time? I mean, one of these things is going to have to give. And most people can't afford to live without money. Most people can't afford to live without a roof over their head or food on their plate.
We're listening back to a conversation we had with food blogger Deb Perlman in July about her piece for the New York Times titled, "In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job, You Can't Have Both." What about you? Are you trying to balance taking care of your children and working from home? What's been the hardest part? Do you feel like you're doing either role very well? What would you need to make this new way of life sustainable? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Deb Perlman, the food blogger behind the Smitten Kitchen website. While we usually talk with her about food, today we're revisiting a conversation we had about her piece for the New York Times, titled, "In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job, You Can't Have Both." And we want to hear from you. Are you currently working from home while also taking care of children who would usually be in school in person or in childcare? Is it sustainable? If not, what would you need to change to make it work? And if it is working for you, what's made that possible? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Deb, one of the things that you point to that is not necessarily a helpful aspect of the discussion when it does happen about this crisis is that you should be enjoying the extra quote-unquote quality time with your kids. How would you respond to that?
I am. It's got nothing to do with the economy, though. I love it. I love not having to miss these months with them. It's always a little struggle. But that does not mean that I should have my economic prospects removed or that I shouldn't work. I might enjoy having them doodle and seeing extra things that they're doing, but that's got nothing to do with it. I feel like what the person is arguing when they say that is they're arguing is, shouldn't you be home all the time? I feel like there is this low murmuring, barely low, below the surface, that actually moms shouldn't be working. And so when we, in the early months, saw a lot of these, you know, people making banana bread with their kids, which, of course, as a food blogger, I am all for, and the crafts and everything else, it seems like a return to classic values, blah, blah, blah. But it felt like it was just people were using it to validate this idea of, you know, of backwards progress.
Let's go to the phones, and Thomas in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, what's going on?
Not much, but what do you have to say?
So I was just going to share my story. All right. So I am an iron worker, so I build buildings, steel, you know, big steel buildings and all that. So we never stopped working. None of us. We're all working every day. And I got the virus, got sick. I was on my back for like a month and a week. And then went right back to work and then had to get back in shape, get my lungs back in shape and all that stuff. And at this point, everything's cool, you know. But, yeah, it took the main issue I had was it took the state so much time to back pay me for the unemployment. That's the only issue I had, you know.
And, Thomas, what's it going to be like if the kids don't go back to school in the fall or if they're only in school a few days a week and you need to go back to work? What would happen for you and your family then?
Oh, their mom does all that. I just pay the child support. I just send the check.
And is she working as well?
Yeah, she's doing some type of thing from home on a computer or something. I don't know what it is.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing that story, Thomas. And Deb, you know, it's every family situation is a little different, but a lot of the elements are the same of, you know, that balance of I need to pay the rent, I need to pay the bills, and my kids need to be taken care of. And then if you get sick, that's a whole other element.
It's terrifying. And I, since the article was published, I've gotten an avalanche of emails from parents, and I have called my inbox one of the most heartbreaking places on the internet because the stories that people are telling me about the struggles they've had since March are just devastating. And, you know, maybe each alone doesn't seem worth, like, you know, changing the course of everything that's happened, but these stories really add up, and you hear about people whose kids have really backslid with a lot, that not getting the services that they needed from school. And I've heard from many people who have been laid off, and, you know, they say it was a staff reduction, but it sure seemed to focus on the people who are having the hardest time juggling. And I've heard from people who say, I accepted a job and that I've been hoping to get for 10 years, and I'm going to have to, you know, not take this job in the end because I can't do it this fall if my kids aren't in school. And I've also heard from people who, you know, they sort of pause their careers thinking it might just be a couple months and they're never going to get back to work. And I think one of the saddest things, we know this disproportionately affects moms. And we also know, because studies after studies have shown, that people who leave the workforce have a really hard time getting back in. I mean, I want to make this clear that, like, I don't think it's on schools to open to, like, save parents' jobs. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, there's a larger conversation that has existed before COVID about why we need universal childcare. And, you know, if you want to look at the, you know, the short-term picture is I think that we need the kind of bailouts for working parents who are trying to school at home that we would have for airlines or banks. We have bailouts for other groups that need it. But in the longer term, you know, I think what this is really laying bare is the idea is that we just don't have good early childhood childcare in this country. We don't look at it as essential because we don't really love the idea of both parents working, and it's held us back. And it's really come to a head since March when any available system of childcare fell apart for basically everyone except for people who had such deep pockets that they could buy their way out of it somehow.
We're talking with Deb Pearlman right now about her recent article about trying to work and take care of your kids during the COVID-19 crisis. And Deb, you make a lot of pretty strong statements in your article, including this one. We are not burned out because life is hard this year. We are burned out because we are being rolled over by the wheels of an economy that has bafflingly declared working parents inessential. And, you know, it is very interesting because people who never would have been called essential workers before are now being called essential. What would it look like if all working parents were treated in that way right now?
I think we would have creative solutions. I think there would have been I think that we would have had to fund schools differently so they could make the changes that needed to be made because the kids would have to be educated. I think right now, if you have some sort of white-collar job or that's allowing you any kind of flexibility to work from home, it kind of looks like things are going okay. You know, we're not really sure if the kids are getting educated, but it seems like they might be. But that's just, it just seems like a really, it's a terrible way to talk about kids' education. Like, they might have sixth grade, they may not have it. Like, it's whatever, we'll find out. Like, that's how we treat, like, our next generation of Americans. It seems really upsetting. So I think that if we had if we considered all parents' jobs essential, because if you have to do it and your kid also has to be schooled, it is essential. It's not as essential as going to work on a construction site or something like that, but it's the same thing where you're expected to do two things. I think we would be taking more seriously the school part, because right now I think it's the kids who are being really getting the worst end of this.
And Deb, briefly, as we start to wrap up, have there been any bright spots during all of this that have helped to keep you going?
There have been many bright spots. I mean, I do enjoy seeing my kids more, although I think that they would be far happier if they were in school and fully thriving. I think it's a challenging time, and I think that if you can survive it, you feel very triumphant. But I also, I've been impressed, you know, by what people are able to pull off and what they're able to do with homeschooling. But I also think if nothing else comes out of this, and hopefully a lot more will, I think that we can all see the invaluable job the teachers are doing and that they should be paid better for what they do, because try to do it for even a week with a 4 or 5 year old. And no matter how smart you think you are, you realize that you're wildly under equipped. And I'm hoping that we'll see a different kind of conversation around childcare after this.
We'll have to leave it there. Deb, thanks so much for joining us today. We were listening back to a conversation with Deb Perlman. She created the Smitten Kitchen blog in 2006. We talked with her in July, shortly after her piece for the New York Times titled "In the COVID-19 Economy, You Can Have a Kid or a Job, You Can't Have Both." You can find a link to that article over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, a new nationwide eviction moratorium is slated to last through the end of the year. We'll talk with a housing law expert about what Wisconsin renters need to know. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday after 8 on The Morning Show, while a quarter of U.S. workers could do their jobs at home, three quarters do not have that option, and that can cause additional stress. A researcher in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington talks with host Kate Archer Kent about how to navigate worker fatigue. Now, the Trump administration has announced a new eviction moratorium scheduled to be in place through the end of the year. The order, which comes from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, protects renters from being evicted if they meet certain requirements. This comes after another federal eviction ban ended in late July and a state-level moratorium expired in May. Economic experts had been warning of another wave of evictions as millions of people deal with lower incomes or job loss during the COVID-19 pandemic. Mitch is a clinical law professor and the director of the Economic Justice Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Law. He's an expert on Wisconsin's rental housing law. Mitch, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here, Judith.
The first question I want to ask is, why did this come from the CDC? Is that kind of unusual?
It certainly is unusual to see an order come from the CDC with respect to rental housing. But we are in the midst of a global pandemic, and the CDC's charge is to take care of health. And so this is framed as a protection for the nation's health, is to create this nationwide eviction moratorium, barring most evictions, not all, but most evictions, to protect certainly the direct health of people who, if they were evicted, might end up in a situation where they get or spread COVID-19, not to mention the indirect health effects, which are substantial.
So millions of people have lost their jobs during the pandemic, and it has been a really stressful time financially for so many people. Paying rent has been one of the big concerns. Have we seen a rise in evictions here in Wisconsin during the pandemic?
Well, so in Wisconsin, Governor Evers passed a statewide eviction moratorium from that was in effect from March 27th through May 26th or 27th. And so during that time, evictions were down 97%. And then so we had, so for instance, from the month from the eviction, we had about 59 evictions from March to April, April to May, 70 evictions. And then the eviction moratorium lifted, and from May through late June, we had almost 2,700 households had evictions filed against them in the state of Wisconsin.
So, how did that work with the eviction moratorium that was part of the Federal CARES Act expiring only on July 24th? How those that happened after the statewide one went away, why were they not covered under the federal?
So this the CARES Act eviction moratorium only applied to federally financed rental housing, so loans that were primarily through federally financed properties. So if lessors had their mortgage loans through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, then it would apply. But that did not cover a large number of folks.
So the state one expired earlier than the more limited federal one, and you said that there was a huge uptick in the number of evictions after the state moratorium expired. What happened after that July 24th CARES Act expiration date? Did we see a similar uptick?
So in the month of June to July, so I suppose that's before the CARES Act, but we've seen another 2,400 evictions in late June to late July, and from late July to late August, another 2,300 evictions filed in Wisconsin.
So this new federal moratorium on evictions, which, as we said, is unusually being issued by the CDC, what kind of impact do you expect it to have? Is this going to be a really useful resource for people in Wisconsin who are at risk of eviction?
Absolutely. This will definitely be a useful resource. If you know, going by the numbers, the state moratorium reduced evictions again by about 97%. And so that through the end of the year, the moratorium goes through the end of the calendar year here. If that holds, if there's no court challenge, I would anticipate that there will be 10,000 fewer families or households that face eviction in the state of Wisconsin.
We're talking right now with Mitch. He's a clinical law professor and the director of the Economic Justice Institute at the UW-Madison School of Law. He is an expert on Wisconsin's rental housing laws, and he's with us to help us understand who can apply for protections under the newly announced federal eviction moratorium that is coming from the CDC. You can join in by calling 800-642-1234. 1234. And Mitch, I want to talk about who qualifies for protection because there are some very specific categories and requirements that you have to meet. So first of all, do people need to take specific action or file paperwork to be protected, or is it just kind of magically in place?
Well, it should have effects that most lessors don't file evictions for non-payment of rent because what you're going to see is a lot of folks who would qualify. So people who are property owners, like myself actually, shouldn't be filing eviction actions if there's a non-payment of rent because you might run afoul of it. That said, if you're a renter, you absolutely should fill out the CDC has provided a declaration form to declare and state that you do qualify. The qualifications, again, are quite broad. One needs to allege that they, or swear rather, that they make less than $99,000 for an individual or $198,000 for a household. They need to have made their best efforts to obtain government assistance for to pay their rent. And further swear that they're unable to pay their rent due to a loss of income or hours or being fully laid off. And again, that they've made their best efforts to make timely partial payments as their circumstances may be permitted. They have to allege that they, if evicted, would likely become homeless, move into a homeless shelter, or live in close quarters, which is often sort of doubling up or tripling up and not being sort of safe occupancy because of an eviction. They also have to swear that they understand that this doesn't forego their rent obligation. They still have to make their rent obligation. They have to, basically their rent continues to accrue, and that the moratorium would expire on December 31st.
And that's a really important point, I think, Mitch, because there have been advocates who have been very happy that this is in place, but very worried that people aren't going to understand, or even if they understand, are going to be hit with this huge bill, probably, unless they can negotiate something, a huge lump sum that could be demanded, say, January 1st.
Yeah, absolutely. The positive way to look at that risk, which is very real, is that right now everyone, lessors and their lessees, have 4 months to work out some type of payment plan, some type of way to make things work. And hopefully, what the other really important thing is that this will provide stability for people to look for work and not have to worry about looking for work and looking for housing or responding to an eviction filing. So hopefully folks are able to work with one another.
And I want to let our listeners know that we will have that declaration form from the CDC linked to the segment note for this conversation. You can find that over at WPR.org/Central Time. Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Susie in Waukesha is up. Hi, Susie.
Hi. So I'm wondering if you can speak to a landlord side of the situation. I have only two very small properties, like two units each. And it is all I make my money on, which is such a low income that I actually qualify for federally assisted health care, for example. Mm-hmm. And I'm on a forum online of landlords who are talking about this. And there has been no moratorium on the payment of the mortgages. So how are landlords, particularly small ones, who are not a huge corporation and can probably afford to float for a while, how are we supposed to do this? People are panicking because we're all saying, look, I'm not going to pay for my own kids' food. I'm not going to be able to pay my own mortgage. This is how I make my money. And if people, you know, I understand from the side of a renter who cannot pay the rent, truly cannot pay the rent because of COVID. On the other hand, there are, in fact, people who take advantage of this situation. And even if there weren't, how do we manage if, you know what I mean? If there's no moratorium for the mortgage payments, we're just going to go belly up. We're just going to.
Okay. Thanks for that, Susie. I want to give Mitch a chance to respond. Thank you so much for sharing your experience. And Mitch, I'm guessing that Susie is far from alone in that situation where she owns just a couple units. It is crucial for her to get that rent to be able to pay her own mortgage, and yet she's kind of caught in the middle here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm right there with you, Susie. I am a lessor, a property owner of two units myself. And so I definitely understand where you're coming from. And I've heard the anger expressed in some lesser forums. Again, I've got to reiterate, people have to work together. There's a couple of things that property owners can think about doing if they haven't. One is refinancing right now. Lessors usually by definition own their own property in addition to whatever rental properties they have. And mortgage rates are at just about historic lows. And that can free up some cash flow or get you extra money to be able to cover things. things. Another important thing that isn't talked about or educated a lot, provided in renter education for property owners, is taking advantage of the various tax breaks that are available for property owners, such as depreciation. And then a third thing is, I understand the urge to push back against folks maybe potentially taking advantage of this, but I think that misses the boat. Nobody wants to not pay rent and have a giant bill come due. Nobody wants to be out of work. The thing to do if you can't work out a negotiation is actually to have lessor associations and renter associations actually get together and lobby together for further financial assistance from both the state and federal government. The state has chipped in, states and counties here in Wisconsin have chipped in more than $50 million, but we need roughly $1.8 billion to cover all of the rent between now and the end of the year. So people need to work together with one another, but also together to lobby for more funding.
And Mitch, am I correct in thinking that there was actually no money attached to this moratorium to, say, help people who own properties or who are renting, that it was just a moratorium?
That's correct. And I want to just, you know, reiterate, we shouldn't see this as a way to divide people against one another. Everybody is in this together, whether you are own property or rent property, or you just own your own household and you're not in the rental game. This impacts everybody because it's so central to stabilizing all of our neighborhoods.
We're talking right now with Mitch. He's a clinical law professor and the director of the Economic Justice Institute at the UW-Madison School of Law. And we're discussing a new federal eviction moratorium that is set to last through the end of the year. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you dealing with financial difficulties during the pandemic that have made paying rent a concern? How has communication been between you and your landlord during this time? And do you think you benefited from the previous eviction moratorium that expired in July? Are you happy to hear about these new protections? And what questions do you have about Wisconsin's housing laws or resources? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with Mitch. He's a clinical professor of law at the UW-Madison Law School, and we're looking at a new federal eviction moratorium in place until the end of the year. And Mitch, I wanted to go back to the situation that you said there was of a huge uptick in evictions, or at least, you know, evictions being filed after the last moratorium. I can't help but think that January 1st in Wisconsin is a really horrible time to be losing housing. Is there concern that there's going to be another big increase then, or is there a possibility of an extension?
Well, don't we all wish we knew what the future would hold? But certainly it would be tragic and very, very cold to see thousands and thousands of eviction filings right after the moratorium expires. So is there a possibility that there might be an extension? Certainly. Is there a possibility that, we might get some financial assistance chipped in? The Democrats in Congress passed a bill, I believe, in the summer that hasn't been picked up that would provide quite a bit of assistance. The governor has ordered special sessions to discuss assistance, and no action has been taken on those measures. And again, people, if they want to see financial assistance, need to unite with folks that they often sometimes oppose to really, you know, make a unified push for financial assistance, which I think everybody agrees is necessary here.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Charlie in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A quick question. Let's say someone comes to a renter and says, please rent me an apartment, and then says, I can't pay you. And then they live there until, say, December and leave. Is that possible that someone can become a new renter claim immediate relief from their rent being required and then leave without having to pay a bill. Thanks.
Thanks for that call, Charlie. Mitch?
So you could probably imagine a scenario, I could imagine a scenario where that might occur. Now, as a lessor, as a property owner who rents out properties myself, most of us would screen renters to make sure, because we don't want, as property owners, we don't actually want to evict people. It's not good for us to go through court processes. I say that as a lawyer, it's not good. So we would look and make sure that they have income available. We'd ask a couple of basic questions. You can run a credit check as part of that application. So it's possible, obviously, that someone might then become unemployed the day after you approve them, and then they might qualify. But again, they have to swear that they're making their best efforts to make partial payments, to get government assistance, to try to make all of these payments in order to qualify for the moratorium. So I don't foresee, there's nothing in the moratorium that orders us as property owners to fill our rental properties with people who can't pay. However, that's a really smart business opportunity if you have vacant apartments to take a lot less rent than you're used to taking, because we don't want homeless people, we don't want community spread of COVID, and some money is better than no money.
We're talking with Mitch right now. He's a clinical professor of law at the UW-Madison Law School, and we are talking about the newly issued federal eviction moratorium and what it means for renters and landlords here in Wisconsin. And let's go back to the phones, and Lisa in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate the information. My question is, I do think that we need to protect some of the tenants. However, who would say that their oath and their agreement to what they're stipulating is true based on the completion of the form? What is the in-depth research or the background to say that if they're being honest or not? I think it's great, but the problem that I have, tenants. Well, I mean, people are going to take advantage knowing that they have 4 months of free rent. The other concern that I have, there's no way I can refinance. You know, there's a process to that, and I'm in debt like everybody else is in debt. So I appreciate the response. Have a good afternoon. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Lisa. And that's a really interesting question, Mitch. The person who is a renter is filling out this declaration. Is there anyone who's actually following up on those things and checking them? I have to imagine it would be a pretty large scale project to do.
Right. So, you know, that one of the concerns is, you know, is someone making their best efforts to pay? So if you get a declaration from a renter, and then you see them, buy a brand new car, you might follow up with them and inquire about that. The law doesn't prevent people, the moratorium does not prevent lessors from filing eviction actions in court. It simply says that you need to prove that this moratorium does not apply to the person. So just like you would have to prove they haven't paid, you would now have to, in a normal eviction, you would have to prove that they could pay. And so normally your evidence is, I didn't get the rent check. Here your evidence would have to be, I know that they're still, you know, that they aren't making their best efforts. And I know that because, you know, I see them, you know, driving around in a brand new vehicle or something. And then the court would sort it out just like any other eviction action.
And we should also make note of the fact that this does not mean people couldn't be evicted for things other than non-payment, correct?
That's absolutely right. If a renter is harassing their neighbor, creating a disturbance, being unsafe, again, we want safe, stable communities. Everyone does, renters and property owners together. And those are still valid grounds for eviction.
Well, Mitch, thank you so much for joining us today. A lot of good information, and I'm sure there will be much more to talk about in the months ahead.
Thanks for your time and attention to this important topic. You have a great holiday weekend.
You too. Mitch is a clinical professor of law and director of the Economic Justice Institute at the UW-Madison Law School. He was with us to talk about a new federal eviction moratorium, which was issued by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to try to stop the spread of the COVID-19 virus when people are being evicted from their homes. That moratorium is scheduled to last until the end of the year. And over at WPR.org/Central Time, you can find information from the CDC, including the declaration form that renters need to fill out. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Monday after 7:30, Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke, a Republican from Kaukauna, will chair a newly formed task force on racial disparities. Republicans agreed to establish the task force after taking no action during a special session on police reform. He joins Kate Archer Kent to discuss the task force's goals and to hear from you.